Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
This evening, we decided to talk about something that we seem to be hearing about all the time, which are clinical trials. And we are joined tonight by Dr. Timothy Marr, who's going to talk about what does it take to be a drug? How do you get from an idea inside someone's head onto the shelves? What happens with recalls? So he's going to give us a little insight into that process. And he'll talk for about half an hour. He'll take some questions. And then we invite you to stick around for casual conversation, enjoy some more refreshments. But thank you for coming, and let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Marr.
Well, thank you, Tinsley. Can you hear me in the back?
Sure.
Okay, great. Such a pleasure to be here back again at the museum to be able to talk about something that I spend a lot of time working on, which is drug development. And I'm at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Boston and at MIT, and I don't work for a pharmaceutical firm, although we have interactions with the pharmaceutical firms. And we teach our students, who are going to be pharmacists and also lecture to medical students, about what happens in the drug industry, because they're the ones who are going to interface with these people and use the products, and consumers are obviously going to be using the products. And so what I'd like to do today is tonight is to review sort of the development of a drug, how one agent becomes a drug, what are some of the pitfalls, what are some of the costs associated with this type of development, and give you some examples of where things go wrong. I think the issue regarding recalls we'll touch on briefly, and I'll be happy to answer questions that are not in the slides. And also I wanted to say a few words about dietary supplements, because many people think of them as being drugs, but in fact FDA regulates those very differently. So why don't we begin? And by the way, most of the slides that I have here are from a colleague of mine, Dr. David Williams at the college, and he teaches a course in drug law and drug development, and he uses many of these in a semester-long course. So what I've done is taken out some of his better slides and condensed them in the hopes that I might be able to review quickly in about 30 minutes or so the issues regarding drug development. And in order for any compound to be used as a drug in this country, it needs to be approved by FDA. And the FDA regulates all of this regarding safety and effectiveness. There was a time back in the beginning of the 20th century when drugs didn't have to be safe or effective, and the Food and Drug Act made it a requirement, a law, that in fact drugs are safe and effective. And it's unlawful to do anything other than to have a drug approved by FDA. You can find yourself in jail for trying to do that. And drugs are things that are intended to diagnose or cure, mitigate, treat, or prevent diseases in man and sometimes in animals, because there are veterinary drugs also. And that is typically the definition of a drug. And with dietary supplements, as we'll see, there's a statement that indicates that they're not for diagnosing, treating, mitigating, or curing diseases, because they're not drugs. But these are regulated by FDA and under the Food and Drug Act. And this is the basic scheme of development of drugs. We start with discovery, and that's typically from basic research. I'll show you some examples of how accidents occur and drugs are developed as a result of that. But basic research, which then leads to preclinical studies. This is where we administer drugs to animals, typically rats, mice, rabbits, and then often larger species like dogs or primates, non-human primates, monkeys, for instance. And then once the FDA has been convinced that the drug you have, the compound you have, is reasonably safe in these animal species and has some potential for efficacy, then you can apply for what's known as a IND, investigational new drug, which I'll review with you in a minute, which allows you to do clinical testing. And clinical testing has three phases to it, one, two, and three, and then you apply for approval of your drug, which is called a NDA or new drug application. And when it is approved, then it can be marketed. And during that time, there's post-marketing surveillance, which is considered phase four studies in humans. And then you know, the product is being launched at the same time, and sales and finances and marketing and commercialization all are very important, because the drug industry is an industry, and they do obviously have to not be in the red. And so this summarizes it again. You can see that they synthesize or purify compounds. The IND, investigational new drug, is submitted. The FDA is required to approve your IND before you can administer any compound to a human, if it's going to be used as a drug. And then it's further developed. During this stage, there are long-term animal studies that are being done to make sure that there's not long-term toxicity. And there are always problems with animal studies, because we never know what's going to happen in an animal will actually happen in a person. And in the future, I think we're finding now and in the future that what happens in one individual might be very different than what happens in another individual. And individualized medicine or pharmacogenomics is an area in the future which I think will revolutionize the way we treat diseases and develop drugs. But phase one, two, and three occur, and then finally the NDA is submitted, and I'll show you some figures as to what the success rates are for compounds going through this whole scheme of drug development. And finally, the FDA has to determine whether you're going to be able to sell your drug or not. And this shows you some of the timelines. In the preclinical years, when we're testing compounds in animals, it typically takes 2 to 4 years. And about 5 out of 4,000 compounds will make it to the IND phase. So there are a tremendous number of compounds that never see the light of day from the standpoint of being administered to humans. And there are many reasons why this can occur. The compound might not be bioavailable. You give it orally and it has no activity at all. It's destroyed in the stomach, for instance. Or it may be so toxic that in animals that the decision is not to move forward into humans. And so 5 out of about 4,000. Now, once the IND is filed and you have approval from the FDA to proceed, then you do phase one, two, and three studies. And phase one is relatively quick. We'll go over these in a little bit of detail in just a moment. 70% of all IND drugs will will be okay. And then going through phase two and phase three, where we have larger number of people receiving the drug, there's 33% of that from phase one will be approved, and phase two will continue through phase two, and 27% in phase three. And you can see that it takes a number of months and then years, and quite a few years actually, to get through phase two and phase three. And this is a tremendous investment of finances on the part of the pharmaceutical firm. And so the pharmaceutical firm is going to, in the end, want to reap their costs back and hope to make profit for their stockholders. When the NDA is filed, it usually takes a year or a couple of years for approval to occur. And of the NDAs that are filed, about 1 out of 5 actually get approved the first time outright. So there's a very steep slope for new chemical entities. They tend to fall off very quickly, and very few of them actually see the light of day. In preclinical studies, anybody can do these. The FDA doesn't oversee these or approve these, but when they're looking at your application to administer the drug to humans. They want to see that you've done studies in an appropriate fashion. On the other hand, as soon as you start to administer it to humans, then there are very significant regulations that are required for how you conduct your studies. And if you don't do these clinical trials the way in which FDA requires, then FDA doesn't accept your clinical trial, that particular study. So you may have spent years and tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and if you haven't done it properly, then FDA doesn't consider it, and you've lost that time and that money. And so the pharmaceutical industry is typically very careful about how they conduct these studies. There are many monitors who are supervising these studies and making sure they're being done properly. Now, the clinical trials that occur, there's no way of knowing once you've gotten your IND, when you administer that first time to a human, whether or not the drug is going to be safe. And so they start off with just a few individuals, and then they may escalate the dose a bit just to make sure that they're not seeing overt signs of toxicity. And FDA's role is to protect us, the citizens of the United States, to make sure that the drugs that we are exposed to are safe and effective. And one thing I would like to stress is that when we say that a drug is safe, a drug isn't going to be is not going to be safe in everybody. And it's important to recognize that there's a risk-benefit ratio associated with any compound. And we have to balance these risks and these benefits. And the risks that will be acceptable for a drug that's going to treat a very difficult disease like cancer or some other life-threatening disease, the risk that will be allowed is much greater than the risk that's going to be allowed for a drug that's going to be for impotence or a drug that's going to be for moisturizing the skin, for instance. So you have to consider what are the benefits and what are the risks and weigh them. The FDA does that in making their decisions. And FDA can stop at any time a clinical trial, and they've done that at times because they have new information that has determined that the drug is not safe, for instance, or is clearly not effective. There's something that has come up recently in the scientific literature regarding that compound, for instance, or that class of compounds. And as I said, there are four phases of clinical trials, and as we run through these, you'll see that it increases the number of people who are exposed to the drug and the doses, typically, as we go through the individual phases. So the first time a drug is administered to a human, it's in a phase one study, and it's 20 to 100 people. And it only takes a couple of months to do this kind of study. They're really not looking for efficacy, whether it's effective in treating a disease. These are typically normal human volunteers, and we're looking for safety, typically. That's the major concern with phase one studies. In phase two studies, we typically have several hundred individuals who are participating, and these are individuals who have the disease that's intended to be treated by the drug that's being studied. And so phase one, normal individuals, phase two, diseased individuals. And sometimes with very serious disorders like cancer and anti-cancer agents, phase one studies will actually be done in patients who have the disease because there's no rationale for giving a dangerous drug. These anti-cancer agents are typically very dangerous, in giving that to a normal person because we know it will produce adverse effects. So phase two, several hundred individuals, and it takes a number of years. And realize that there's a lot of money associated with running these studies as we go out longer and longer. And as we go out longer and longer, the later we find that a compound is actually toxic or not effective and is not going to make it to being a commercial product, the more it costs. And therefore, there's an advantage to finding out earlier on that a drug isn't going to make it. So companies actually would prefer to know at the end of phase one or early in phase two or even in preclinical trials that a drug isn't going to make it because they'll save a lot of money. The further you go out, it's exponential the amount of money that you're spending. In phase three, we have a much larger group of individuals who are going to receive the drug, and this is typically thousands. It's typically across the country in different sites, multiple locations, and that typically takes anywhere between 1 and 4 years. And the purpose is to collect information about safety, about the dosage. They also do pharmacokinetic studies to see how the drug is distributed in the individuals. And they make an extrapolation to the population. I realize that they still just have a sample. This is a number of thousands of people, but it's still a sample compared to the population. And once a drug is approved, after the NDA is approved, and it's now out there for so many people to take, then that's where you sometimes see adverse effects that were not seen during phase one, phase two, or phase three. So the numbers of people are increasing, and we're more likely to see adverse effects that might only occur in 1% of the population. But if an adverse effect only occurs in 0.01% of the population, but it's a very significant adverse effect, we might not see it during phase three even. So it might get approved, the drug. And then it may be during post-market surveillance where we see the adverse effect. So the new drug application after phase three, everything is okay, is submitted. It has a tremendous amount of information in it about the preclinical data and then about the human safety and efficacy data. And then all things about labeling, this all has to be approved by FDA. Patent information is important. And I understand that when these are submitted to FDA, at least a number of years ago, there would be a convoy of trucks from Merck or Pfizer or wherever, which would drive down to FDA, and they were just loaded with these documents. So an NDA, an NDA might fill up half of this room, for instance. It's just a huge amount of information. Now, it always took FDA a long time to review these NDAs and get approvals or disapprovals. And so in 1992, Congress passed an act which requires the pharmaceutical firms to submit a payment for review of their products. And this is called a Drug User Fee Act, and it has led to some concerns on the part of critics of the pharmaceutical industry, indicating that they're paying for their review and therefore they might be looked upon more favorably. And I don't know if that's the case or not. I hope that the FDA is not influenced by the fact that the users are paying for the review. During the review, they look at safety and efficacy. Those are the two most important things, safety and efficacy. And they do a risk-benefit analysis. And so safety is the risk, and benefit is the efficacy. And then when you do that analysis, then you make a decision, is this going to be good or is this going to be bad? Are there more pluses or more minuses? What type of disease is being treated? And really, it really does come right down to the risk-benefit analysis. And if the benefits far outweigh the risks, then the drug is likely to be approved. But remember, only about 20% of them that get to that NDA stage actually get approved on their first time through. Labeling is very important. The pharmaceutical firms are interested in having labeling which is positive, reflects positively on their product, whereas FDA is looking after the interests of protecting the consumer, the patient. And labeling is regulated very carefully, and one of the things that pharmaceutical firms really try to avoid is what's called a black box warning. And that means that, sure, the drug has some risks and it has some benefits, but there's something about it that everybody needs to be aware of, and and it's something very serious. And it's called a black box warning. If you look in the package insert, you'll see this, and it catches your eye, and it makes physicians much more reluctant to administer that type of a drug, especially if there are other choices. Sometimes there are no other choices, And this has been the issue with a number of drugs, a struggle between the pharmaceutical firm and the FDA as to whether or not this severe warning, this black box warning, should exist. And this makes up part of what's in the package insert, what patients receive if they're interested when they receive their prescriptions. The package inserts, really, you need a microscope sometimes to read them. Or, as you'll see with advertisements on television, on the radio, you have to read so fast because they're just flipping by you. And so they really are not very useful from that standpoint. If somebody wants to read very carefully a package insert, they can do that. And I think much of it is for legal reasons that they exist. Now, once a drug has been approved, the company starts to sell this, but they are required by law to have post-marketing surveillance. You can't just start selling it and then forget about what's happening with your drug. And during post-marketing surveillance, there's adverse reaction reporting that's required, and I'll show you a couple of slides on that. The drug can sometimes be withdrawn, and we've seen that happening more and more with compounds recently. And these are called phase four studies, these post-marketing surveillance studies. During phase four studies, there's also a concern regarding off-label use of compounds. Physicians can write a prescription for a drug to treat any disorder that they want with any drug. And FDA approves a drug for a specific indication, but they don't regulate how physicians can prescribe. So sometimes the pharmaceutical firms will apply pressure or use tactics to try to influence prescribing patterns of physicians so that they might use a drug for something that it wasn't necessarily intended for initially. And that may be valid. There may have been scientific studies which suggest that, yes, this might be useful. And this is the way we make discoveries, obviously, is by experimenting. But sometimes there can be pressure applied to physicians, which is inappropriate. Okay. All adverse drug reactions must be reported to FDA. And if it's a very serious adverse reaction, an alert report must be filed within 15 days of the event. And FDA collects all of this information, and the holder of the NDA, which would be the pharmaceutical firm, the company that's selling the product, they must review and submit quarterly reports of any information that they receive regarding adverse reports. And sometimes these adverse reports are compiled effectively, and it does indicate that there is a problem with a drug, and it leads to a drug withdrawal, or maybe a black box warning, or some other change in the labeling. Now, adverse reporting, in 2003, the FDA received 370,000 reports of suspected drug-related adverse events. And MedWatch, which is one of the systems that FDA has for monitoring adverse events, had about 23,000. 144,000 were from the manufacturer, and these were the 15-day serious adverse events that occurred. And in the periodic reports, about 60,000. And then non-serious manufacturer periodic reports, these are the quarterly reports that are required, about 144,000. But if you look at the top line, 370,000 adverse reports. Drugs are wonderful things. They can do wonderful things for the body for disease states, but they also have a dark side. And they say that all drugs are poisons. It really just depends upon the dose. And I think what we're also finding is that it depends on the individual, because some individuals, because of their genetic makeup, may be much more susceptible to adverse effects. So I mentioned off-label uses, and it's been in the news recently with some products that were physicians were being pressured to use drugs, and this blew up in the news, and there are a number of high-profile cases, Neurontin being one of them, for instance. Now, you probably heard something much recently about the switch of drugs from prescription to over-the-counter. And an over-the-counter drug is a drug which, again, is approved by FDA. It's allowed to be prescribed. It's allowed to be sold without a prescription, so it doesn't have to be prescribed. And but they do have to be safe and effective. Dietary supplements, on the other hand, which are not intended to treat, cure, mitigate diseases, they do not have to show safety or efficacy. And we'll differentiate those in just a moment. But what we're finding is, more recently, there have been a number of switches from prescription to over-the-counter. The advantage of going over-the-counter is that the pharmaceutical firm can typically sell much more because you don't have to go see a physician. On the downside, there's increased risk of adverse events, especially if the drug has significant risk associated with it. So FDA typically does not approve drugs that have significant risk associated with them. They're typically products that are treating diseases that are less serious, like maybe acid reflux or analgesics, aspirin, Tylenol, those types of products. And those are some of those criteria listed here. they're typically self-limiting, non-serious diseases. The FDA feels that the lay public can be trusted to take these appropriately, to comply with dosing scheduling, not to be misused. There's no habit forming characteristics of the compounds, and they're typically oral or topical. They're not IV or via any other route of administration. So it is really a long journey from the time that the first chemical was discovered to the time that it actually meets the marketplace, if it actually meets the marketplace, because there are so many of them that don't. And this kind of summarizes some of that, showing you the drug discovery process during phase 1, 2, and 3, where we get to the FDA approval of the NDA. And of the compounds that are tested, very few of them actually make it all the way through. And you can see the hundreds of millions of dollars that are typically associated with the development of these drugs. Drugs will drop out because they're not stable, they're not bioavailable, they're not absorbed, for instance. They may have toxicity or they don't have efficacy. And there's so many that drop out, so few of them actually make it. And some drugs, on the other hand, are discovered sort of by accident. And here's a list of some of them. A number of these compounds just happen to be found by accident. Many of the drugs nowadays are not discovered by accident, but in fact there's a programmed scheme which is used for developing drugs. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad, because you can sometimes lose compounds that would normally be excellent drugs, but because of the rigidity of the scheme, they get dropped out. And they have to do that, obviously, for financial reasons, because if they make 100,000 compounds, they obviously can't develop all of them. And the sooner you drop a compound, the better off you are financially. Now, compounds that are designed after natural products, some of these are listed here. These are compounds that are used for lowering blood pressure, for instance, or used for treating certain types of cancers. Other products, the statins, some of those have been in the news recently. And it's just a whole list of compounds that mimic natural products that are found within our body. So if we understand the biology or the biochemistry of the body, we can sometimes find compounds that we'd like to mimic, we'd like to act like them, or we'd like to antagonize them. And there are just a tremendous number of products, Vioxx, Celebrex being examples of those. Okay. Nowadays, there's been a shift, although we still do traditional drug discovery and development, there's been a shift to looking at more gene-directed discovery. And now that we know a lot about the human genome, there'll be ways of determining activity of compounds or predicting activity of compounds based on gene products. And I think in the future, the next 5, 10, 20 years, there'll be a significant number of drugs that will be developed as a result of the information we know about the human genome, as opposed to making 10,000 drugs and finding one of them that works. So to summarize some of the timelines, it takes about 4 years of preclinical testing, a year a little bit less than that for phase one, phase two about 2 years, phase three, 3 years, FDA review is 1 to 2 years, so it takes about 12 years. And patents run 17 to 20 years, I believe. so there's the companies need to try to recoup as much of their costs as quickly as they can. So there is that pressure that they have, obviously. And if you start with 8 to 10,000 compounds, drugs that enter development will be 12 to 18 only. So a lot of failures. Drugs that enter clinical trials will be 6 to 9, and one of those drugs out of 8 to 10,000 will be marketed. So it's a not a very successful operation when you think of how many drugs have to fail. Now, these numbers are just a little bit old. This sums up to about $500 million for the development of a new chemical entity and all the costs associated with doing the screening and the bioavailability, all the clinical trials. And so phases 1 through 3, in this case, cost about $120 million. But total is about $500 million on this slide. It's more close to probably $800 million nowadays. You've all heard about generics. Generics are companies that or products that are identical to a brand name drug, but as soon as it goes off patent, then anybody can manufacture it and sell it, as long as it's approved by FDA. So you do have to do an amended new drug application, and that costs about $25 million in this case. It's probably about $40 million, the numbers today. But that's significantly less than another larger pharmaceutical firm and who's developing these drugs from scratch. And there was a time when we referred to a Merck or a Pfizer or any of these larger pharmaceutical firms as being an ethical drug company. And I don't know that that meant that the generics were unethical companies, but they do impact significantly healthcare cost, and it's excellent for competition if you're a consumer, for instance. But that's part of the reason I think that the pharmaceutical firm is more likely, the larger firm is more likely to sell their product initially and to promote it as much as they can, because they have a limited window to recoup their costs. I want to say just a few things about direct-to-consumer advertising, because a number of years ago, a pharmaceutical firm was not allowed to advertise to consumers. They could advertise to physicians. There were textbooks and things that they could look at and have information put into those textbooks, but the patient or the consumer and the pharmaceutical firm were at a distance. They never communicated with one another, really. And one example recently was that the FDA ordered Viagra to pull their Wild Thing TV ads. There were a number of these that went on the TV for a short period of time, actually. There are still advertisements, obviously, but they had to modify what they say and what they're trying to portray in these advertisements. As it turns out, with the ordering to pull these Wild Thing TV ads, the TV ad was, this is FDA speaking now, said that they omitted the approved indication for the drug and failed to provide information relating to the major side effects and contraindications of the drug as required. And there are a number of parameters that advertising must follow, and FDA did not feel that Pfizer and with Viagra, with these ads, had followed those requirements. Okay. Now, nowadays, people get information regarding drugs from a number of different sources. 30 or 40 years ago, people would get their information from their physician. And the physician was sort of this person who was locked up in their office, and whatever the physician said, people would typically do. They had godlike stature. And nowadays, though, people are much more accessible to information. And oftentimes, because of direct-to-consumer advertising or because of information that they might have obtained elsewhere, they will go to their physician and they will say, well, I would like to take this, I would like you to prescribe me this drug for this disease. As it turns out, sometimes the person doesn't have that disease, and it's a totally inappropriate drug, and I'll show you some slides about that. But probably the biggest source of information for people has been the internet as far as increasing over the years. Healthcare professionals still give us a lot of information, but the one which is increasing the greatest is probably information from the internet. So if you know you have a doctor's appointment and he's going to be discussing your thyroid problem with you, you might go on the internet and do a Google search of thyroid treatments, and you'll find all kinds of information. And when you do that, most people are looking for side effects. They're not as concerned about benefits or effectiveness or cost, but they know that there typically are a lot of compounds, and they're trying to find ones that have the least number of side effects. So that was patients. If you ask physicians, though, what are the benefits of having all this information now available, most physicians will say that they have a better discussion with the patient, about 53%, and they're more aware of the treatments. On the other hand, what are the problems associated with people having too much information, if there can be a problem? From the physician's standpoint, in this survey, they found that they spent a lot of time correcting misconceptions, because people reading things on the internet need to realize that anything that's written there is not necessarily correct. It may be tremendously skewed. It may be absolutely wrong. It's not peer-reviewed. And if it's read by somebody who's not trained in a medical field, there may be subtle parts of it that they just don't understand. And that's why we train physicians the way we do, in the hopes that they'll be able to understand these things. Okay. So in summary, direct-to-consumer advertising increases the awareness of possible treatments, but they don't always convey information about all the risks or benefits equally, and especially if it's from a site which is biased in some way. And they can confuse patients. As I say, patients will go see physicians and will request a certain drug, and it may be the exact opposite of what they need. They figure they saw it on TV and it seemed to work for that young guy, so maybe that's what they need too. Okay. I mentioned off-label use of products, and there's been this story with Neurontin, which is a drug which was approved for treating epilepsy, but then was started to be used for treating other disorders, such as neuropathic pain and also bipolar disorder. And the allegations are that the pharmaceutical firm were pressuring physicians. One of the tactics that they used that I heard was they'd invite them to these fancy dinners, and they would make the physicians feel that they were the only ones in the city of Boston who were not prescribing Neurontin for treating bipolar disease. So they were applying this pressure to them. As it turned out, there was a whistleblower associated with this case, and there were internal documents that were found, and they clearly indicated, in fact, that the company involved with doing this was not following the spirit of the law. And I think this was Pfizer. I think that there was a $430 million fine, including a $240 million criminal fine associated with this case. So the individuals in the pharmaceutical firm are humans. They all make mistakes. They're not all good. They're not all bad. Many of them are wonderful, hardworking, caring individuals. But there are individuals who don't, who should not be allowed to have this type of power or influence. Okay. One of the concerns that FDA has regarding off-label use and also with direct-to-consumer advertising is misleading advertisements. And these are some of the compounds that recently have been cited for having misleading ads. And this is just a partial list. Okay. Now, I did want to say a few things about Vioxx, because that's been in the news. And Vioxx was, its NDA was approved in 1999, which means that it could be sold for acute pain, osteoarthritis, and dysmenorrhea. As of May of 1999. Now, the company, because they're required to do phase four trials, continued to test this product for other indications, but also for safety. And in 2000, there was a preliminary result of a study called Vigor. And in that study, it suggested that there might be some adverse effects. And there are a number of slides that I don't have with me, which cover sequentially month by month what has happened with with Vioxx. But just to show you briefly, the acute myocardial infarction or heart attacks, cardiovascular events associated with the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or NSAIDs, which these products are examples of. If you look at the last, the second to last and third to last lines, those are that's Vioxx. And if you look at the adjusted odds ratio for acute myocardial infarction incidence, you can see that when the dose is greater than 25 milligrams, that there's a 3.15, and the 95% confidence intervals are 1.14 to 8.75. And for a significant odds ratio to be realized, you have to have the 95% confidence interval that does not, overlap one. So you can see, for instance, with less than 25 milligrams, Vioxx in this with this analysis that was done, while the odds ratio appears to be increased, so it's 1.29, it's actually not significant because the confidence interval did cross one. So the one that's significant here is Vioxx with higher doses. And as you know, that was removed from the market. The issue that's of concern now is whether or not the other COX-2, cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors like Celebrex, are going to also be removed. And I think currently Pfizer is evaluating this, and they've decided that at this point they're not going to remove Celebrex. But I think there's a concern with all of these compounds because it does seem to be a class effect as opposed to an individual agent. And then finally, just to say a few words about dietary supplements. In my laboratory, we've done a lot of work with dietary supplements, and these are products that are not intended to treat, mitigate, cure diseases. And dietary supplements came about in 1994 with the DSHEA Act, Dietary Supplements Health Education Act, which indicated the way in which FDA would regulate or not regulate dietary supplements. These are products which are labeled as dietary supplement. You'll see this on the labels all the time. The what transpired before 1994 to precipitate the DSHEA Act was that there was an incident with tryptophan. And L-tryptophan was used for sleep, also for pain, as an antidepressant at times. But it wasn't a drug. But if I tell you that a compound is used for sleep, pain, or antidepressant actions, then I'm talking about a drug. I'm not talking about a food. And so there was sort of this in-between area. And as a result of the L-tryptophan situation, where a manufacturer in Japan was making so much so fast because it was such a demand that they were not purifying the L-tryptophan properly. They had cut back on the charcoal purification step. And as a result, there was this tryptophan abnormal product, which were two tryptophans linked together, which seemed to produce this disease state or this problem called eosinophilia myalgia syndrome. And that precipitated withdrawal of tryptophan from the market. You couldn't sell it anymore. And then that was in the late 1980s. And in 1994, what happened was Congress approved the DSHEA Act, which then allowed compounds to be sold as dietary supplements. I was part of an expert panel in Washington, which was contracted by FDA to look at the safety of amino acids, because that's what L-tryptophan is. And we concluded that there is no safety data regarding any of the amino acids, and that they should be treated like drugs if they're going to be used for sleep or pain, etc. And in fact, if you take any individual amino acid in excess, other than as part of protein, it probably has an anti-nutritional action, especially if you're very young. But despite the fact that we published that report in 1992, in 1994, Congress decided to disregard that and passed an overwhelming act known as DSHEA. And the concern of the public regarding their right to have dietary supplements was so strong that this bill, which was sponsored by Orrin Hatch of Utah and Kennedy of Massachusetts, had so many people call in. The only issue in Congress which had had more communication via phone or via faxes or letters, the only issue that had greater amount of communication than DSHEA when it was being considered was the Vietnam War. And so people really felt strongly that they should have their dietary supplements. And a tremendous number of people use dietary supplements, and oftentimes they don't tell their physicians, for instance. And I'll slip through that. The concern that we have regarding dietary supplements is that are they safe? And because they don't have to be shown to be safe before they can be sold. It's the requirement of the FDA to determine whether a dietary supplement is safe. Whereas with a drug, it has to be shown safe and effective before it can be marketed. With a dietary supplement, you just have to notify FDA that you're going to sell this, and unless they have some good reason why you shouldn't, then you are allowed to sell this. And then it's FDA's requirement to show that it's not safe. They don't have to show non-effectiveness because there is no efficacy associated with dietary supplements. They're regulated more like foods. But as I tell students about dietary supplements, when I go to a store and if I buy a dietary supplement that's supposed to have ginseng or it's supposed to have isoflavones or something in it, and I pick up the bottle and I open it up and I take out a capsule or a tablet, there's no way that I can tell, in fact, that that has ginseng or isoflavones or whatever in it. I really can't tell. And we actually, in our laboratory, have analyzed a number of products for isoflavones and for St. John's wort active ingredient, and we found some that had absolutely none. So they probably didn't hurt you, but you're probably wasting your money selling them. But regards of food, if you go to Star Market and you go to buy a food and you want to buy a carrot, and in the bin where it says carrots, there are tomatoes. As a consumer, you know that that's not what it's supposed to be. But as a dietary supplement, it's, I like to say, the Wild Wild West, because we really don't know what are in these products. And people will not bat an eyelash to spend $30, $40 for a bottle of this, whereas my students who are pharmacists tell me that they complain that they have a $5 or $10 copay for a drug that's going to potentially save their lives. So I think the consumer has to be aware that you really don't know what's in these dietary supplements. And probably the safest situation is where there's nothing toxic in them and maybe not the active ingredient even. So here's an example of one, Trim Spa. And there are so many that you could choose from. And it's largely about advertising. This is something that's supposed to help you lose weight. One of the products is called Hoodia, and it's from a cactus. There have been some concerns about it, been aired about it. Whether or not it's safe or toxic, I really don't know. But here's an example of the things that are in this product. Chromium and vanadium, those help with insulin's action, typically. It has glucosamine, I guess, in case you're having joint problems. And glucosamine actually has some utility. There have been some studies to show, in fact, that it does have some activity. Cocoa extract, so it has phenethylamine, which is in some ways similar to ephedrine or amphetamine, but not as strong. Tyramine, which could be a real problem if you're taking a monoamine oxidase inhibitor as an antidepressant, or even if you're taking some other antidepressants. Green tea extract, there's antioxidants are associated with that. And there's the Hoodia. But again, you have no way of knowing if these things are actually in there. And we've done some studies, and we know, in fact, that some of the products have none or 20% of what they claim to have. Okay. And so with that, I'd like to finish up by saying that many compounds that are developed to be drugs never make it to humans. And those that do make it to humans, a number of those eventually aren't going to be satisfactory either. They're going to be removed from the market. And I think as the FDA is concerned with the safety and efficacy of drugs, and the pharmaceutical industry is interested in obviously staying afloat, there are at times potential conflicts. But I'd like to think that most of the individuals in the pharmaceutical firm are caring individuals, and also concerned about the laws, because if it's found that they break the laws, they can end up in jail just like any one of us can also. So I've kind of surveyed drugs from beginning to end, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have that I might be able to answer. So, sure. Yeah, well, those are the regulations, and that's our government. There's one thing that I would strongly urge not happen, and that is have the government in charge of developing drugs, because if you think the bureaucracy that the pharmaceutical firm has to deal with now is bad, if the government, if our government were in charge of it, I think that would be a real problem. I don't think we would advance very quickly. In the private sector, there are incentives for people to be imaginative, but then there may also be incentives for people to be dishonest at times. And I think that's a small portion of it. I think most people are very conscientious and caring. But I don't know how to streamline it anymore. I think the regulations are in place because people did do things that were not appropriate, and FDA said that our job is to make sure that people are safe. Now, there have been activists, for instance, AIDS activists who got drugs approved faster, they applied pressure. I think for very serious diseases that FDA does fast-track things. You can get things through much faster if it's a serious disease. But nowadays, with some of the drugs that are being considered, many of them are so-called me-too drugs. In other words, they act just like another drug that happens to be out there. And so there really should be some significant advantage about them for FDA to approve them. But, you know, on the company's stamp, from their viewpoint, they need to be able to sell their drugs too. So there's this balance. Yeah. Sure.
Question about the animal studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all studies that are done in vertebrate animals, rats, mice, monkeys, dogs, whatever, all have to be approved by a committee. In each institution, whether it's a pharmaceutical firm or a university, has a institutional animal use and care committee, an IACUC it's called. And so they require that we justify why we're using animals. And yes, there are many test tube assays that we can do, and there are also computer modeling that can be done, but eventually nobody will ever get an IND to be allowed to give a drug to a human unless you've tested it in animals. Now, the number of animals that are being used is significantly less, and they used to refer to something as an LD50, a lethal dose 50. Nowadays, there's we need to know the toxicity of these compounds in some living system, and you can't always fully realize that using computer models. But the numbers of animals that are used is significantly reduced. Yeah.
Can I just ask a follow-up?
Sure.
What kind of oversight is there? Because I know in the cases where they do have to use animals, there are sort of rules and regulations in terms of how you treat those animals, like particularly primates.
Yes.
Make sure that the laws that do protect the way the animals are treated during that time are enforced. use?
Yeah, we're regulated by federal guidelines and the use and care of animals. And the institution's committee is responsible for overseeing what's being done. And these committees that are comprised of scientists, a non-scientist, and also somebody who is an ethicist, clergy or legal individuals, it's their responsibility to approve studies, to consider them, to approve them, to offer alternatives if alternatives are available, and to then make sure that the studies are being done appropriately. And if people don't follow those rules, then the institution has the authority to do something to that individual, to reprimand them, to fire them, to remove them from doing any studies, remove them from the company. Now, it's Pfizer or I work at the Mass College of Pharmacy or at MIT, and the person's name who is on the IACUC committee, the person who signs off on that committee, is the chief executive officer of whatever entity it happens to be. So in my case, it's the president of my college. So he has a vested interest in making sure that we're following these rules, because if we're not, his name, he's the one who's responsible. He's the one who's going to be called in and have to deal with this. So there'll be abuses in anything, but it has significantly increased the regulations regarding how we use animals and minimize significantly their use in pre-approval, in preclinical trials. Yeah. Okay. How about right here?
I have a question about using drugs for children. Mm-hmm. So all the studies are done on adults and then are prescribed for children. And how does that happen? How do we approve something that's just a full-grown adult? Do we further test it done with the last?
Yeah, FDA has some regulations regarding pediatric trials. Sometimes there are drugs that are just for pediatric patients. And they have to have a much greater benefit and much less risk, typically. But oftentimes, the pediatric population is referred to as therapeutic orphans, because you're exactly right. We test these typically in healthy individuals initially, and then we find some disease patients, but children very rarely. Now, a physician, you may say off-label, can prescribe any drug to any child, and I think that's the way in which a lot of the initial trials occur. They're sort of the physician-initiated form. But there are separate guidelines regarding safety and efficacy testing in pediatric populations. Yeah.
Have we looked at, I work with children with behavior disorders, and so we prescribe a lot of somewhat serious drugs to 8, 9, growing children. And have there been any studies done, or are there any studies done, what the effect of giving
Well, you can do some of those studies in animals, and what we typically find is that it has dramatic effects on, neural connections and other factors. And so, I don't think we know exactly what happens with these drugs in developing kids right now. I don't think it's probably very good, but 50 years ago, these kids probably would be locked up somewhere as opposed to being in society. So. Yeah.
If a company is fast-tracking a drug, at what point do they apply for a fast-track, and what does that do?
They have meetings with, the companies will have meetings with FDA, and if this is going to be fast-tracked because they realize that there's a critical need for this kind of compound, there's nothing else in this therapeutic class, there's a real need for this, then FDA is the one who determines what phases 1, 2, and 3 will look like. So it's a negotiation that they have with FDA. Well, you probably have some idea that you'd like to fast track, yeah, based on the indication of the agent, yeah. So, right, yeah.
I was wondering if there's just been a real difference in the climate, political climate, economic climate around this whole Vioxx thing. I remember just around the time I finished it seems like there are people recruiting Vioxx patients now.
Oh, if you do a Google search on the right-hand column, you'll typically see all the legal requests, you know, sign up with me, sign up with me. With the example that you give with Celdane and erythromycin is a good example because in the preclinical, in the clinical phase 1, 2, and 3, and even initially in phase 4, there probably weren't many people who were taking those two compounds together. And, you know, that produces that QT interval prolongation, which leads to arrhythmias. And it required hundreds of thousands of people before something like that was picked up. And so that's why I say if you can test it in many, many people, you're more likely to see these very rare events that are going to occur. And, you know, I don't hold responsible a pharmaceutical firm who sold Celdane because they didn't know this. It wasn't something that they would have necessarily known because they can't test every combination, obviously. Nowadays, though, most drugs are now tested to see if, in fact, there is this interaction to cause QT interval prolongation. Yeah. Now, how about over here?
Hi. I have a first question about dietary supplements. So you said, as a consumer, you really don't know what's in it, but they're legally required to put this supplement effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm familiar with, you know, buying computers. So if you go buy a computer, it says it's got a G4 processor in it, then, you know, when you come back home, open up the box, you expect that's what's in there. But so to what extent can we trust the supplement panel, you know, the supplement information that's on the bottom of the dietary supplement?
Well, personally, from my experience in the laboratory and analyzing a number of these products, I'd say you have no confidence whatsoever. I'm just telling you the truth. We looked at a number of St. John's Wort products, which have hypericin and hyperforin. Those are two supposedly active ingredients. And what we found was that there were some products that had absolutely none. And then we also tested isoflavones that are used for menopausal symptom reduction, and we found some that had none, actually none.
That's because there's no oversight of the...
That's right. Currently, there's no oversight. For the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe, there's been a rule proposed for good manufacturing practices for dietary supplements, which means that they would, in fact, have to verify what the contents are. Now, they do label what's on them, but that's not always what is in them. And if these good laboratory good manufacturing practices occur, then the profits for the supplement producers is going to go down, or the price of the products are going to go up even more. So, yeah.
Following on.
Sure.
What about vitamin pills? I mean, how is it different from you go and buy a multivitamin pill?
Well, vitamins are regulated just a little bit differently. So I think if you buy a vitamin product from, a reputable firm, even if it's a store brand name, because they're made by the larger companies typically, you're probably getting the vitamins. But they're regulated differently than drugs. And I'll just tell you briefly, when you go to the pharmacy and you look on the shelves, and you know, for instance, that there's a bottle of Trim Spa or some other dietary supplement there, or St. John's Wort. And then, you know, one aisle over is aspirin or Tylenol. Now, one would think that, you know, they're in the bottles, they look fine, they must be manufactured exactly the same way, but they're not. Any over-the-counter drug, such as Tylenol, aspirin, anything that's available over-the-counter as a drug used to treat, cure, mitigate diseases, has to be manufactured a certain way. And in manufacturing that, if you use a 20-liter vat to make it, and that's what your standard operating procedure says you're going to do, if you decide to use a 10-liter vat instead, you've just violated your SOP, you've broken the law, and you're not allowed to do that. So it's very, very regimented because drugs are serious compounds.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.